Welcome to Work of Art, the Mason Gross podcast, produced out of Rutgers University's Mason Gross School of the Arts in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We are a community of nearly 1,200 undergrad and graduate dancers, musicians, theater artists, filmmakers, and visual artists from around the globe. My name is Laurie Granieri, and I'll be sitting down with some of these artists, discussing what fuels their curiosity, their passion, and their impulse to make. Composer Alan Shawn was understandably thrilled in the early 1980s when the legendary clarinetist Benny Goodman commissioned a classical piece from him. But, as Shawn tells it, when Goodman ultimately decided not to perform the work, he essentially shoved the composition in a drawer. Now, 36 years later, the Rutgers Symphony Orchestra is yanking Shawn's concerto for clarinet and cello out of the drawer and bringing it to audiences here in Central Jersey. The piece, featuring Mason Gross faculty Maureen Hurd House and Jonathan Spitz as soloists, will make its world premiere at the New Brunswick Performing Arts Center on September 28, 2019. Goodman, known as the King of Swing, enjoyed a robust classical career, both as a performer and a commissioner of classical works. Shawn's concerto, a piece that he describes as wild and joyful, is in fact Goodman's last classical commission before his death in 1986. The concerto has never been performed with an orchestra until now. We love that a youthful disappointment has morphed into a triumph of sorts as Shawn finally sees his work on the concert stage. As he tells it, he feels that his concerto has been rescued and that this younger self is available to me. Shawn is a professor of music at Bennington College in Vermont, as well as a respected composer and author. He has written books on music, as well as acclaimed memoirs about living with phobias and about his autistic twin sister, Mary. He is a son of the late William Shawn, the legendary and longtime editor of The New Yorker, and the brother of actor and playwright Wallace Shawn.
So, Alan, talk to me a little bit about how you brought your work to Rutgers.
Okay. Well, there's a long, long road between the youngish composer who wrote this piece and Rutgers. So I met Benny Goodman in 1981, which really sounds like the Middle Ages at this point.
Right.
I was 32, turning 33. I am now 71. I met Benny through a mutual friend, and since I was excited to meet him and wanted him to hear some of my music, I brought him a piece of mine called Cabaret Music, which was for clarinet, violin, cello, and piano. And I had been a child composer. I started at the age of 10. But that doesn't mean I was a mature composer at the age of 10. In fact, I didn't really write a piece that I thought was a decent piece until I was about 30. I composed all that time, and I studied, of course, a great deal. But Cabaret Music was a piece I'd written in 1978 when I was 30 years old, and I thought it was actually finally a pretty good piece. And it was an 8-minute, very condensed piece that had some flavor of cabaret and jazz-like material, but it was, you know, a classical concert piece. And Benny liked it very much, and he said, well, I'd like you to, you know, come over to the house and meet Nathaniel Rosen, the cellist, and I've been playing music with him, and we can read through the Beethoven trio and read through the Brahms trio. As you know, Laurie, you know, there are quite a few important trios for clarinet, cello, and piano. We think of the piano trio as violin, cello and piano, but there are a number for clarinet, cello and piano. And Benny said, you know, maybe you can write something for us. So I was very excited, and I went to Benny's house several times, and we read various things. I might have read through some of the Brahms clarinets and others with him. I can't recall that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he very quickly asked me to write a concerto for clarinet and cello, and said he would commission me.
Did he give you any specifications? Was he, you know, how much was his hand on your shoulder here, or did he just say that? How many specifications did he give you?
None.
Wow.
Clarinet, cello, and orchestra. And he said, you know, maybe we can play it with. Actually, he mentioned the New Jersey Symphony, which is such an interesting coincidence. But for your listeners, they should know that Benny Goodman was one of these extraordinary musicians who is not only in one genre of music. So he was a composer and arranger and performer in the jazz world, and actually he was legendary in many ways, not just for swing music, but also Maureen can maybe say more about this than I can, but I believe he was really a path-breaking musician in terms of breaking the racial barriers and having integrated ensembles and so on. And he was also a superb classical player as well, and performed Mozart clarinet concerto, and was really a wonderful musician in classical music as well. But he'd commissioned many pieces in the past, including, for example, the Aaron Copland clarinet concerto, and the Bartok contract clarinet, violin, and piano. So in a way, I had those pieces to go on, and as an inspiration. I knew what he played in the past. That's the main lead I had.
That's interesting. Exactly. You know what he was drawn to.
Yes, I knew the composers. He'd also commissioned Hindemith, I believe. He commissioned Mio, and he didn't care for the... This is a Darius Mio, the French composer. He didn't care for that piece, and he didn't play it, which, of course, is relevant to what happened in my case. Mm-hmm. So I wrote... I was very excited. This was a tremendous opportunity for me, and I started work on the piece, and I brought the first two movements in a kind of piano version with, you know, piano with clarinet and cello to Benny and Nick, as we called Nathaniel Rosen, and we worked on it, we read it, and we played through it, I think, not just on one occasion, but more than one occasion. And I was starting the third movement when I got the distinct impression from Benny that he just didn't think he would be able to actually learn this piece for whatever reason. Whether it was that it ended up being too gigantic a work. You know, my cabaret music was only 8 minutes, and this piece is 25 minutes. Or whether he... didn't feel up to, he was 74 at that time, whether he didn't feel up to it, whether he didn't care for it, whether he thought it was, it had problems as a piece or technically, I'm not sure. He played the hell out of it. He was fantastic, and Rosen as well. But I remember distinctly that it was clear that, you know, he was telling me that, unfortunately, you know, this would not have a public outing with the two of them. So this was disappointing, and I finished the third movement, and then I orchestrated it and put it in a drawer, basically. And this, so I completed the work in 1983, and you know, composers or artists of every kind have to deal with setbacks. And particularly when you're starting out, you might have a picture of what the life of a composer is or a painter. You might have a few experiences that support that, the most positive vision you have of yourself, you know, that you're going to be attending major openings and mm-hmm. people will be very enthusiastic about your work.
Was that your idea? I mean, tell me what your idea of what the life of a composer would be. I know it's hard to remember what it was, right? But give me an idea of what that picture was in your head, even if it seems naive now.
Right. Well, I think that by the time I met Benny, I'd already had my ups and downs in terms of whether pieces were played, whether they were played well, whether they were appreciated by performers or audience members or critics. I was fortunate enough to hear a good deal of what I wrote, but I also knew that it was tough being a composer, and that you had to work very hard to support being a composer in doing other things very often. And certainly that was my case. I was playing in shows. I was doing some arranging for people. I hadn't done any word writing, but that was in my future too. But I guess that I did picture each opportunity, I would get very optimistic, and I would think, oh, this is going to really change my life. And there were a few people I knew who had experiences of that kind. And, of course, I would say any young artist hoped that I might be one of those people, too.
To have lightning strike in a good way.
Exactly. Meteoric rise from obscurity. And I would say my life has been more tortoise-like.
Well, right. It was a different trajectory, right? Not quite. I wanted to ask you, because as you're talking, something came up for me, and I'd be very curious about your take on this, Alan. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems as artists, there's a requirement to be sensitive to the world, right? To a certain extent, to have a sensitivity, whether it's being an observer, right? Being open. And yet to be a successful artist, boy, you have to have that tortoise shell to deal with the vicissitudes of the artistic life, because it seems the meteoric rise is the exception and not the rule. How do you square the two? Being both kind of hard-nosed enough to deal with disappointment and yet sensitive enough to be an artist in the world?
Well, I think you have to have a fierce determination, and you have to be in touch with your sort of inner core. You have to, you know, remember the show, I don't know if you remember the show Get Smart.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sort of cone of silence that they run into. the artist has to have this little cone of silence in themselves, and they have to, obviously you keep changing, you evolve, but you have to be able to reach down into yourself and rediscover with each piece, you know, who you are and what matters to you as a composer. So even this incident with Benny was perhaps a little bit of a clash between what he might have expected and what I actually found in myself that I needed to do. it's a strange piece because on the one hand, it has a very, very extroverted character. It's a pretty wild and joyful work on the whole, but there's an ambition and a seriousness behind it that was what I was finding in myself at that moment. So that the sort of obsessive detail in the piece is a little bit almost at war with the extroverted character it has.
But that makes sense to me, given how you've spoken about yourself. Alan, you've commented that your music tends to be more expressive and outgoing than you are. And you've also talked and written at length, of course, about your own phobias and anxieties. So when you describe this piece, that makes a lot of sense to me. You know, that obsessiveness you describe and that wildness on the other hand, right?
Totally right. I mean, in later years, I'll flash forward just for a second and say that the intensity and the seriousness that is sort of lurking beneath the surface in this piece are much more in the forefront of my later work as I got older. There's a lot more of my music that is highly introspective and even dark and more just expressive of those internal things. Whereas this one sort of straddles the two in a way that I think is very interesting, but is complex, and it might not have been quite what he was bargaining for.
Well, I'm wondering, too, that mix, right? The person you were, the composer you were, and what you reached for there. How do you relate to that person now, looking back at who you were and what you expressed in this concerto?
Well, you know, when I heard the reading, so I can bring you a little more up to date in terms of what happened at Rutgers. We didn't never got back to that, but I would say this is a almost a different person in some respects because of this sort of duality, which I was not entirely aware of. You know, today, if I write in a style that is as outgoing as this, as much of this piece is, I'm very conscious of the duality, and it has a more refined kind of quality to it. I reconcile these warring impulses with more awareness. But what I would say is I was very touched and very excited and very joyful to re-encounter this uninhibited work. I found it exhilarating to hear the first movement that I attended at Rutgers in the spring of 2017. It was really a fantastic experience to me because I felt that the piece had been rescued, you know, and this younger self was suddenly available to me. I could check out what I was trying to do at that time. You know, we composers have to hear our work in order to learn. And learn who we are and learn what we can do better and learn how to orchestrate and all these things, you know. So it was a tremendous experience to re-encounter that younger self. But it did seem like a different self. You know, I have three children. This was before I was a parent. You know, what a life-changing experience that is. My parents were both alive. It's a different lifetime. I'm just excited that I got to hear the music, and now I'll get to hear the entire piece, which is fantastic.
Yeah, you talk about it being tremendous. I can imagine, you know, looking at yourself and feeling in some ways connected and in some ways as if you're looking at someone else. What a strange and fascinating interaction.
Absolutely. But I also relate it to a lot of the music that I love, you know, from the past, in which you have this strange combination of reflection and attempt at being meticulous with very outgoing music. So, for example, Mozart, you know, you get this sense that this person was comfortable in a large group of people and going to a party, but at the same time, he's sort of unknowable, actually. And you know, there's such depth there to the music. Stravinsky also has this quality of a strange combination of sometimes being full of joie de vivre and sociability and geniality, but actually he's you know removed in a way from society and he's writing his work in a very almost monastic space. I have a bit of that myself. I mean, I have this sort of reclusive lifestyle, but there's obviously a party animal in there somewhere.
Well, I'm very interested in that, and I love that. I wonder if so as I alluded to earlier in our interview, you've spoken and written at length about struggling with phobias, and you've noted, you know, that you don't like heights, bridges, tunnels, subways, elevators, vast spaces, closed spaces. And what I'm wondering, and you have a good sense of humor about it, how does music affect these phobias, if at all? I mean, is there something in music that made you turn to it to offset the phobias? Maybe not consciously, but I'm interested in that relationship between turning to making something and making music outward and the phobias.
Right. Well, I would answer that two different ways, and you'll mm-hmm. have to sort out which one is more true.
I'm there. I'm ready.
Okay. So the first way would be to say that in music, I don't have phobias. You know, in music, I have a sense of adventure. I am able to do things that might hurt me in the sense that I, you know, if I have to write a certain way and other people don't like it, well, that's just too bad. You know, I do it. I take risks. In fact, I am not interested particularly in hearing a piece in which I haven't taken a risk, certainly an emotional risk of being frank, you know, and saying something. I want to reach people with my music. So in a way, it's almost the opposite of phobic. You know, it's an arena in which I can be fully myself and almost free. You know, people who have a speech impediment when they sing lose their speech impediment very often. They sing completely fluently, but they stutter when they speak. I think it's a little bit that way for me, you know, with composing, that I'm freed of these constraints. However, I would also say I could make a little bit of a case for signs of what you're talking about, in the sense that my path in music has been a very slow, dogged one, and it started with the known, things that are known to me. In other words, not the vast open space, but the reassuring space, something that I could understand. So I really started composing almost as if I'd been born 30 years earlier than I was, with materials that I truly could hear and grasp. And, you know, I never wrote just gestural music that was completely, I didn't start with the idioms that were actually around me at the time of my childhood. I started, in a way, with idioms that were even already a part of history. For that being related to my need for knowing where I am.
For rooting yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's funny because now, first of all, my music doesn't seem to have dated because it was so old-fashioned that when I wrote it, they definitely dated. It's a very strange phenomenon. My music is definitely not, does not sound older than when I wrote it. It sounds younger than when I wrote it, which is really strange. The other thing is that as I've aged, I've totally caught up with the present day. And that's a very curious phenomenon, partly because of what's happened to the present day.
Just talk a little bit more about that. This is interesting.
Well, what I mean is, as I proceeded, I mean, I was always writing from a very, what I felt to be an honest place within myself. But my idiom seemed to me pretty old-fashioned. I was very fascinated by the traditional forms. I wrote for acoustic instruments. I was trying to hear and feel every note. I was not the slightest bit interested in being a timbral innovator, for example. Everything went into just trying to write a decent piece. But as I got older, I started being much more influenced by later 20th century music. And then in the 21st century, in the last, you know, almost 20 years now, the music the people are writing is so varied that my work started to feel like it really did fit into the current landscape in its own way, in spite of being pitch and rhythm music for acoustic instruments. I don't feel like an outsider. I feel like all the composers I meet are my peers. So something changed in me, something changed in the world. I evolved, and of course I've lost my in a way some of my caution about myself. So I present myself in a way more confidently, I guess, than I used to.
Which is interesting because you've commented that your music is more expressive and outgoing than you are, but then you mentioned that as you're getting older, the music is perhaps a little more wedded to how you present yourself out in the world.
That's correct. That's right. Mm-hmm.
And does part of that go back to what you were just saying about letting down some of those that guard?
Absolutely.
So aging brings us something at least, right? We may be in more pain, but there's that sense of maybe being more comfortable with ourselves.
Oh, absolutely. There's definitely a sense of it would be silly to be spending your later years, if you're lucky enough to get older. It'd be silly to be spending that time trying to prove something. You know, you are what you are. And basically at this point in life, I want to experience things. and I want to experience the deeper aspects of things, and also the more real or better. You know, that I love taking walks. You know, I certainly did when I was 30. I didn't take walks at all, except that, you know, you have to walk in the evening. But now I just enjoy walking and being in nature, and being a creature feels like a marvelous thing now in a way that it didn't before.
Well, and I'm wondering what it's like for you, talking a little more at Rutgers, what it's like for you to meet yourself now in this piece. And maybe you can talk to me a little bit about Maureen's role in resurrecting certain parts of this, just so that the listeners can understand really the significance of this performance on September 28th.
Right. I'm so glad you asked about Maureen, because here's what happened. So literally 12 years ago, that's a long time in itself, Maureen was writing her dissertation on Benny Goodman. And she took an interest in, she read about this piece and took an interest in it and called me and did an interview with me about it. And I guess at that point she heard the version I did for Piano Trio, which I had done in 1984, or a year after writing the concerto. And that is recorded and around, although it's a briefer and leaner version of this work. And she started to sort of strategize about how to revive it and do a premiere of the actual concerto. And it's taken this long, but I owe her an enormous debt of gratitude for that. I don't know what it means that all of this has taken such a long time, but it is significant. I think in the end you have to give Benny Goodman a lot of credit for being willing to take a chance on me at that point in my life, even if he didn't end up playing it. That's, you know, there's also the fact that he initiated it and was interested enough to do that, and that's the sense of adventure too on his part.
So, and what that must have done for you as a young man, even if it didn't go exactly the way you wanted it to, I can imagine it was just such a boost for your confidence, and perhaps kept you going. Who knows?
Well, I think it was a little of both, wasn't it? You know, it was a boost to my confidence, and then it was a disappointment. And I think a young person, if we can call 31 to 33 young, is sort of trying to read the tea leaves about his own future a little bit, so, or her own future. And so a setback like that also can seem like bad news, and you sort of think, wow, how many of these am I going to have, and what does it mean? But it is, so I think it was a bit of both. The fact is, I did keep going. So I think I used the phrase fierce determination before, and it's sort of not what I see when I look in the mirror, but I think I think it's there, and I think any artist has to have that. And you know, it has to be the kind of determination that makes you listen to yourself rather than your teachers sometimes, which is I don't know if I want my students to hear that, but it's true. You know, you have to, you know, I remember Boulanger telling me, for instance, that one of my pieces sounded like Schoenberg. I didn't like it. I remember saying to her, "Mademoiselle, that's the first piece I've written which I really feel connected to." And you have to know what you respond to. So, but I can't deny that for all those years, until I heard the reading at Rutgers, I assumed that my concerto didn't work. That's what I really thought. So that's important to, that's part of the story.
Oh, wow, so the Rutgers reading made you realize, hey, maybe it does work?
Yes.
What a revelation.
The Rutgers reading made me question that assumption. It made me think, wow, maybe I was onto something here with this mix of influences and this idiom, which I worked on enormously hard. When I recorded the trio version of this piece, the engineer said, man, that piece is certainly not tossed off. You must have worked on that for years. And I said, well, yeah, there's a bit of a history behind it. but it does sound very spontaneous at the same time. It's, you know, it just sounds extremely natural. And that's the result of hard work.
Well, isn't that the art, right? that somehow it sounds tossed off, but it doesn't mean you didn't sweat it out as you did it. You know, I want to go back to your fierce determination for a moment, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You know, not to play armchair psychologist here, but where do you trace that fierce determination? You know, I know you grew up around writers and journalists, your parents, your brother. You know, did you see that in the editorial process with your father at The New Yorker, or talk about that?
Sure. Well, yeah, I would say I see, well, you could, if you're going to be psychologist, you can mention my sister too. You know, I have an autistic twin sister. That's a whole thing in itself.
And she's in an institution, no, Alan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
And I've written about that too.
I know
and,
you have. Yeah.
So that's a source of learning about life also that I think has to be mixed in. I don't want to be armchair psychologist of myself either, but it's obviously a formative experience. In other words, I guess to be blunt, I had an experience very early of that was extremely mysterious and that involved loss and involved learning about the fragility of what a person is. And that, you know, if a few wires are connected in a different way in a brain, that a person is not as expected and has struggles that are not, you know, usual.
Well, the person who was closest to you, I mean, literally closest to you, you know, when was your sister institutionalized, Alan?
She and I were both 8 years old. So I guess I would say about that if you have an experience like that, and God knows, almost all of us have had tragedies and unexpected things. We all have things to deal with in our lives. That's life. But I guess I'm saying there was an urgency in this young person. There was a need for an outlet to express things. And that need is probably the source of the determination. In other words, I can't live without doing this, even if it's flawed, even if it's a struggle, even if it's not always well received, even if it takes a lifetime to do it well. So on the one hand, there's this urgency and there's an emotional need for an expressive outlet. But I also had you know, a role model at home, as you say. And my father was somebody who was very shy. I mean, almost pathologically shy, but also had a strong center and knew what he thought, and often did things that were quite bold and courageous within the quiet-seeming domain of it being a magazine editor, such as publishing Rachel Carson or James Bald, other controversial, Hannah Arendt, other controversial writers. And he was a jazz pianist by ear at home and loved jazz. So, and that was where he cut loose from his shyness.
Well, and that's interesting. I wonder why you chose the vehicle of music as opposed to, and I know you have eventually, you have become a writer on the page as well, but your first instinct was toward music.
Right. And that came, you know, from him and from all the music we heard growing up, which was a tremendously fortunate thing to have. I realize not everybody has that.
Not everyone was going to see Thelonious Monk, right?
And no.
Right. You were being fed a pretty dynamic diet. That is for sure.
I don't think it could have been better. I mean, it was like everything. Yeah.
Well, look, thank you so much for taking this time to talk to me. I'm so grateful. And I'm really hoping that when people hear this, they'll be inspired to come listen on September 28th. And we're looking forward to having you here as well.
Thank you. My pleasure, Laurie. It was really fun.